The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 264, Sacrificing the Children, Why the Church Won't Fight Child Sexual Abuse, a paper by Janice Merrill Allred. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all here, and thank you for coming. If and when I get to heaven, the first thing I want to learn how to do is to be in about five or six places at once so that I can come back to Sunstone and be in every session concurrently. There are so many good competing sessions right now, and we're just thrilled to see so many people here in this one and with the understanding of what an important subject this is. My name is Rita Bowles. Amongst other things in the last few years, I've been an interviewer and a writer for the Case Reports Committee of the Mormon Alliance, and this is where I have come to know Janice much more closely than I did before. She was just a name at the bottom of things I liked to read before. And now I know her as a very intelligent and compassionate person with a very supportive husband and 9 wonderful children and 2 grandchildren. Janice is a trustee of the Mormon Alliance and president of the Mormon Women's Forum. She's been writing and speaking on theological subjects for many years, and she is the author of an upcoming book from Signature entitled God the Mother and Other Theological Essays. She is also the co-compiler and co-editor, along with Levina, of this book, Volume 1 of the Case Reports of the Mormon Alliance. And if any of you here have ever been sexually abused or have known someone that was sexually abused, or if you are the parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents of children who are sometimes left with others, babysitters, kind neighbors, Relief Society and primary and Aaronic priesthood leaders, etc., etc., you need to read this book. It is very disturbing, but it needs to be read. As Levina explained earlier, we didn't begin listing these cases with the knowledge that we would have so many people calling and writing to speak about cases of sexual abuse. But they were so overwhelming by the numbers and by the sincerity of those who called to speak and to be interviewed that we felt it was necessary to speak first and foremost of the sexual abuse that's currently occurring and has been occurring for a long time. And that is the focus of Janice's speech today. She's here to speak about why the records show a significant number of child abuse cases among LDS church members, and why, all too often, local priesthood response has been inadequate or inappropriate. Janice?
Sacrificing the Children, Why the Church Won't Fight Child Sexual Abuse. In The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky, Ivan, the intellectual agnostic brother, and Alyosha, the believing brother, discuss the eternal questions, the existence of God and immortality. Ivan says, "It's not that I don't accept God. You must understand, it's the world created by him I don't and cannot accept. Let me make it plain. I believe like a child that suffering will be healed and made up for, that in the world's finale something so precious will come to pass that it will suffice for all hearts, for the comforting of all resentments, for the atonement of all the crimes of humanity, of all the blood they've shed, that it will make it not only possible to forgive, but to justify all that has happened with men. But though all that may come to pass, I don't accept it. I won't accept it." Ivan explains that what he cannot accept about the world is the suffering of children. He has collected many stories about the cruelties inflicted on children, and he tells a few of them to Alyosha. Incidentally, Dostoevsky himself collected these stories from the newspapers. He tells about a boy of 8 who threw a stone in play and injured the hound of a general, an owner of great estates. The general had the boy stripped naked, made him run, and then set his whole pack of hounds on him. They caught him and ripped him to pieces before his mother's eyes. He tells about a little girl of 5 whose parents beat her, thrashed her, and kicked her. He says, Then they went to greater refinements of cruelty, shut her up all night in the cold and frost in a privian because she didn't ask to be taken up at night, as though a child of five, sleeping its angelic sound sleep, could be trained to wake and ask. They smeared her face and made her eat that excrement. Can you understand why a little creature who can't even understand what's done to her should beat her little tormented breast with her tiny fist in that vile place in the dark and cold and weep her meek, unresentful tears to dear, kind God to protect her? Yvonne cries, I must have retribution. I want to see with my own eyes the victim rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly understands what it has all been for. But then there are the children, and what am I to do about them? That's a question I can't understand. I can't answer. I understand, of course, what an upheaval of the universe it will be when everything in heaven and earth blends in one hymn of praise, and everything that lives and has lived cries aloud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. When the mother embraces the fiend who threw her child to the dogs, and all three cry aloud with tears, Thou art just, O Lord, then of course the crown of knowledge will be reached and all will be made clear. But what pulls me up here is that I cannot accept that harmony. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself on the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse with its unexpiated tears to dear kind God. It's not worth it because those tears are unatoned for. They must be atoned for or there can be no harmony. But how? How are you going to atone for them? Is it possible? By their being avenged? But what do I care for avenging them? What do I care for a hell for oppressors? What good can a hell do since those children have already been tortured? I don't want the mother to embrace the torturer who threw her son to the dogs. She dare not forgive him. Is there in the whole world a being who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? I don't want harmony. From love for humanity, I don't want it. I would rather be left with the unavenged suffering. I would rather remain with my unavenged suffering and unsatisfied indignation, even if I were wrong. Alyosha accuses Yvonne of rebellion against God, and Yvonne responds, Tell me yourself, I challenge you, answer. Imagine that you are creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last, but that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that little child beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Tell me, and tell me the truth. No, I wouldn't consent, said Alyosha softly. Of course, the idea of an innocent child being sacrificed in order to bring about the happiness of all mankind suggests the atonement of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice of the Son of God for the sins of the world. And Alyosha quickly responds to Yvonne's challenge by reminding him of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Alyosha says, You said just now, is there a being in the whole world who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? But there is a being, and he can forgive everything, all and for all, because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything. You have forgotten him, and on him is built the edifice, and it is to him they cry aloud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. It is not the little child, the most helpless, dependent, and powerless of us all, who is sacrificed to redeem us from our sins, to bring about our eternal happiness, but the greatest of all, the Almighty God, the Lord Omnipotent, the Everlasting Father, who sacrifices himself and brings to pass the atonement. As the prophet Abinadi taught, God himself shall come down among the children of men and shall redeem his people. And Alma declared, God himself atoneth for the sins of the world. God sacrificed his glory, his immortality, and his power to become a helpless, mortal human baby. As a man, he taught, blessed, and ministered to the people around him, and finally subjected himself to the power and judgment of the church and state, and sacrificed his mortal life in a humiliating death on the cross. For it behooveth the great Creator that he suffereth himself to become subject unto man in the flesh and die for all men. Jesus' sacrifice provides a model for relationships between people with unequal power. Through his incarnation and atonement, he made himself equal to every human being, thus establishing the equality of all people. The principle of human equality, which can be defended philosophically as well as theologically, underlies the notion of abuse. Certainly people differ in personal characteristics, power, and physical, social, economic, and cultural circumstances. The principle of human equality means, from a religious perspective, that all people are equally valuable in the sight of God. From a political perspective, that all people are entitled to certain basic human rights, including self-determination and a voice in all group decisions affecting them. and, from a social perspective, that everyone should be treated with respect and fairness. Because of an inevitable human differences, some relationships are inherently unequal, and unequal relationships, by definition, always involve a difference in power. Some relationships which involve an imbalance of power are parent-child, teacher-student, pastor-parishioner, and therapist-client. The principle of human equality demands that whenever one person in a relationship has more power than the other, he or she should use that power to benefit rather than exploit, dominate, humiliate, or coerce the person with less power. The person with the greater power should not expect to have his or her primary needs met in the relationship. Of course, some secondary needs, giving needs, may be met in the relationship, and sometimes the power may voluntarily give something to the person in the more powerful role. However, whenever the more powerful person uses his power to take advantage of the less powerful person, he is abusing his power and abusing the other person. To avoid abuse, he must grant the other person her free agency. The sexual abuse of children is surely one of the worst, if not the worst, form of abuse. Children are powerless not only in some roles, but simply because they are children. They are dependent on adults for everything, for the necessities of life, care, protection, education, emotional and physical support, knowledge, training and social skills and expectations, and above all else, love. For little children are dependent on their parents to provide the foundation for their self-esteem. There is no relationship that involves a greater imbalance of power than that between parent and child. Sadly, historical, social, and psychological research reveal that parents too often use their power to exploit, humiliate, and dominate their children. Even worse, this abuse is tolerated and even sanctioned by society. Alice Miller, a psychotherapist who has researched and written extensively on the abuse of children, writes, "For millennia, it has been permissible and customary for children to be used to satisfy a wide variety of adult needs. They have provided a cheap source of labor, an ideal outlet for the discharge of stored-up affect, a receptacle for unwanted feelings, an object for the projection of conflicts and fears, compensation for feelings of inferiority, and an opportunity for exercising power and obtaining pleasure. Among all the different ways of misusing a child, sexual abuse is of particular significance." Although estimates of the prevalence of child sexual abuse vary, all studies indicate that it is widespread. Some studies have found that from 30% to 35% of all girls are sexually abused before age 18. Statistics given by the Boy Scouts of America and the National Committee for the Prevention of Abuse indicate that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before age 18. Growing up in an LDS home does not protect Mormon children from this abuse. The statistics on the prevalence of child sexual abuse apply to all large populations. One study of the sexual experiences of married Mormon women from very religious homes indicated that 26% of the 89 women in the study had been sexually abused as children. This figure agrees with that reported by the Boy Scouts of America and the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse. It seems reasonable to suppose that the sexual abuse of children occurs in Mormon populations for the same reasons that it occurs in the general population. Certainly, Mormons are no worse than others. But why aren't we better? A church that identifies itself as an advocate of families and family values and promotes itself as an organization that supports families and teaches its members how to achieve happiness in family life should have a low incidence of child sexual abuse and effective ways of dealing with the problem when it occurs. The church should help in the healing of victims and survivors, support and cooperate with government and other agencies that deal with the problem of child sexual abuse, and aid perpetrators in stopping their abuse and repenting of their sins. The Mormon Alliance has recently published the first volume of its case reports. This volume deals exclusively with the problem of child sexual abuse in the church. It documents 388 cases of the sexual abuse of Mormons, usually children, and identifies 183 separate perpetrators. It shows that often church leaders respond to child sexual abuse by denying, minimizing, or covering up the abuse, blaming the victim, re-victimizing the victim, punishing victims and their advocates, and showing more concern for and giving more help to the perpetrator than the victim. It shows that church leaders often exhibit a deplorable lack of knowledge about child sexual abuse, that insufficient attention and resources are given to the problem, and that some church leaders seem more concerned with protecting the image and money of the church than helping the victims. Levina Fielding Anderson wrote most of this volume, but as the other co-chair of the case reports committee, I was involved in all stages of its preparation. Though I knew something about many of the cases reported, I was not prepared for the emotional impact of my first reading of the entire volume. I was deeply grieved by the suffering of the children and angry at those who had abused them. However, knowing something about the psychology of abusers, I was able to have compassion on them also. My strongest anger was directed at those church leaders who have not been willing to feel the suffering of the children and use their power to protect them and aid in their healing, either as children or as adults. Why has the church responded so poorly to this problem? My own thinking, studying, and writing about the growing problem of authoritarianism in the church and incompatibility of authoritarianism with the gospel of Jesus Christ suggested a connection between the church's authoritarianism and the abuse of its children. In this paper, I explore what I believe are the deeply rooted reasons for the church's failure to respond effectively to the problem of child sexual abuse. I hope to show that it is wrong, not because it is sexual, but because it is abusive, and that other kinds of abuse, which are widely accepted in the church, are like child sexual abuse. Thus, I hope to help Mormons use their intuitive understanding that child sexual abuse is evil to understand the evil inherent in other forms of the abuse of power. My thesis is that we cannot stop child sexual abuse as long as we believe in and support a power system which sacrifices the weak to the powerful. Let me make it clear. Let me make it clear that what I am saying represents my own thoughts. I'm not speaking, and maybe some of the rest of you too. I'm not speaking as a trustee of the Mormon Alliance, and what I say does not necessarily reflect the position of the Mormon Alliance or the views of any of its trustees. Clinically, child sexual abuse is the sexual exploitation of a child who is not developmentally capable of understanding or resisting the contact and or who is psychologically and emotionally dependent on the offender. It may involve fondling, exhibitionism, masturbation, and genital penetration. Any sexual contact between an adult and a child is abusive because a child, by definition, cannot give consent. She is immature. She lacks knowledge about sexuality. She is often dependent on the person who abuses her, and there is always an imbalance of power between an adult and a child. It is important to emphasize this point because it is often overlooked or not understood by perpetrators and victims, as well as by those attempting to help. It is sometimes believed that children consent because they do not protest, physically resist, or tell anyone about the abuse. But they do resist abuse in all these ways. But their resistance is usually not very effective because of the determination of the abuser and his greater strength, power, and knowledge. Initially, children may not realize what is being done to them. Then, when the molester's actions become frightening or painful, they may feel that they have already consented. When they do protest or cry, the threats of the abuser to injure them further usually silence them. Abusers often threaten the child with horrible consequences if she tells anyone what happened. He may threaten to hurt or kill a loved one, or he may tell her that everyone will blame her if she tells. Children who do tell are often not understood or believed. Children resist sexual abuse emotionally through various defense mechanisms such as dissociation or splitting off or multiple personality development. The child's powerlessness and lack of consent is starkly depicted in this account of child sexual abuse. My father started abusing me when I was 3 or 4. I have memories going back that far. I remember feeling very scared and not quite sure what was going on. I tried to tell my mother once, and it resulted in my mother and my father beating me up. I remember as a child doing things to try to stop him from getting to me when I was in bed. Things like getting into my little brother's bed and sleeping next to the wall in my childish attempt to hide from him. But he would find me and drag me out. When I think about what I went through, I don't know how anyone can talk about incestuous relationships when a child is involved. The balance of power is so off. A child doesn't have any power in that situation. I never had any power. I couldn't say no. Children may also submit to the abuse because they feel that they are protecting the family or another family member. One survivor of incest wrote, "I felt that if I didn't do what he wanted, everyone else would suffer. He would just go on more at my mom or my sister. He would make life unbearable for everybody. So I felt that I had to put up with it. What else could I do? I was a child and I thought like a child. I didn't understand the options. I thought I was protecting my younger sister from him. It wasn't until we were adults that I plucked up courage to ask her, 'Did Dad do anything to you as well?' When she said yes, I said, 'Oh God, I thought I was protecting you. I felt so guilty.' That's the feeling you get, guilt. Although the child resists in so many ways, she nevertheless is made to feel guilty for being abused. The perpetrator may tell her that she made him do it or that she is bad and deserves it. Although the child is in no way responsible for being sexually abused and cannot consent to sexual contact with an adult, survivors of child sexual abuse must deal with the problem of shame and guilt. This problem is often intensified by the ecclesiastical response to child sexual abuse, which frequently blames or punishes the victim in overt or covert ways. Because of their lack of consent, all children experience sexual abuse as a loss of control, of being dominated or violated by the abuser. Because of the lack of consent, child sexual abuse is a form of rape. Even when genital penetration does not take place, child sexual abuse is experienced as an assault on the person. One woman writes, "For a long time I wondered if I was an incest survivor, if incest had anything to do with me. Because my father didn't have sexual intercourse with me, he sexually abused me in other ways by coming into my room at night and touching me. I think what I've learned is that it doesn't matter what happens physically. The point is that trust has been abused and power has been abused and that you've been sexually violated." One researcher prefers to use the term rape rather than incest because incest focuses attention upon who is involved rather than what is happening. She writes, "I use the term rape because I believe that the sexual use of a child's body being is the same as the phenomenon of adult rape. To be raped as a woman or a girl child is to experience an act of aggression in which the survivor is denied her self-determination. Understanding child sexual abuse as a form of rape permits us to use the extensive research on the meaning and motivation of rape to better understand the nature of child sexual abuse. Marie Fortune, in her book, Sexual Violence, The Unmentionable Sin, writes, "Clinically, rape is regarded as a pseudo-sexual act. It is an act which has the appearance of sexual activity and that genital contact is involved. However, rape is only pseudo-sexual because it is committed in order to fulfill non-sexual needs related to power, anger, and aggression. Rape involves hostility, anger, and control, power, more than passion. Anger and a desire to control the victim are the primary motivations of the rapist. These factors are consistent with the victim's experience of sexual violence. The victim feels violated, dominated, and powerless." The research of clinician Nicholas Groth offers evidence that men who rape are not primarily sexually motivated. Groth writes, "It is commonly and mistakenly assumed that men who rape do so either because they are sexually aroused or because they are sexually frustrated, or both. In fact, as we have seen, the motives underlying such assaults have more to do with issues of anger and power than with pleasure and desire." One rapist reported, "It was one of the most satisfying experiences I've ever had. I got more pleasure out of being aggressive, having power over her, her actions, her life. It gave me pleasure knowing there was nothing she could do. My feelings were a mixture of sex and anger. I wanted pleasure, but I had to prove something, that I could dominate a woman. The sex part wasn't very good at all." The victim of rape feels fear and a sense of powerlessness, which involves both a loss of self-determination and a loss of bodily integrity. In being raped, one's whole self is violated. Many victims feel that they are going to be killed. Children who are sexually abused also experience fear and a loss of control, but their experience also involves a feeling of being exploited. Child molesters probably do not experience their need to act out their anger and aggression to the same degree that rapists do. Since their power over children is a given, child molesters are more often using their dominance to exploit children rather than attempting to prove their dominance as rapists are. Alice Miller writes, "The child in his or her helplessness awakens a feeling of power in insecure adults, and in addition, in many cases, becomes their preferred sexual object. Children readily understand the difference between loving physical affection and sexual exploitation. Many survivors of incest report their sudden realization that the nature of their father's touching had radically changed. Children sense that they are being used to gratify the sexual desires of the abuser. 'You exist for my pleasure at this moment,' is the message they receive in being sexually exploited. Such a message undermines their self-esteem and their sense of their right to self-determination. The gender bias that exists in our culture cannot be overlooked as part of the motivation for and the meaning of child sexual abuse. Feminists interpret child sexual abuse as a manifestation not simply of an adult-child power imbalance, but also a manifestation of a male-female power imbalance. One study found that 97% of child molesters were heterosexual males. Statistics on the incestual assault of children, that is, abuse of children by family members, indicate that in less than 1% of reported cases is the offender a female relative. Although nearly 40% of the victims of child sexual abuse are boys, their sexual victimization is not usually perpetrated by homosexuals, as is commonly believed, but by heterosexual or bisexual men. Indeed, almost all child molesters identify themselves as heterosexuals. They often state that they are attracted to the young boy's feminine characteristics. Florence Rush writes, "Traditionally, women and children, male and female, have been cast together. They have shared the same minority status and have been exploited as domestic and wage slaves. Since both women and children have been lumped together as helpless, dependent, and powerless, they even share the same feminine gender, and consequently, both have been sexually used and abused by men. Because our culture connects dominance with maleness, male eroticism seems to be inherently aggressive, and sexual violence is a way of asserting and proving one's power and ability to dominate. Violence itself is constantly in danger of being eroticized, which means that violent acts in themselves become sexually arousing for some men. The romantic love ideal in our society is based on the formula of dominant male, submissive female. This formula encourages the eroticization of aggression and permits male sexual violence against women and children as a signification of male superiority and the realization of the male sexual prerogative. One study found that sexual violence is not inherent in male sexuality, but is a response which comes from the way societies are organized. Peggy Reeves Sande, in a cross-cultural study of rape, found that in 47% of the societies she studied, rape was absent or rare. Rape-prone societies exhibited certain behavioral patterns and attitudes. Sande writes, "These societies tolerate violence and encourage men and boys to be tough, aggressive, and competitive. Women take little or no part in public decision-making or religious rituals. Men mock or scorn women's work and remain aloof from childbearing and rearing. These groups usually trace their beginnings to a male supreme being. On the other hand, rape-free societies show respect for women in many ways. Women participate fully in the religious life and have an equal role in ritual activities, and the primary deity is female or male-female. In these societies, women and men cooperate in work and decision-making." Is child sexual abuse wrong because it is sexual or because it is abusive? When I began research on this paper, I naively believed that child sexual abuse is universally condemned. However, I learned not only about the horrible history of the sexual exploitation of children and women, but also about the rationalizations that have been used to support it. When rationalization has been deemed necessary, that is, whenever women and children have not been regarded simply as male property to be used in whatever way the owner pleases, the sexual nature of the abuse has been emphasized and the fact that it is abusive has been overlooked. Frequently, sexual abusers project their own sexual desires onto the child and assume that because they enjoy it, she does too. Freud rejected the evidence he collected that showed that adult psychological problems are frequently the result of child sexual abuse perpetrated by the child's father, and instead postulated his drive theory of infantile sexuality. According to this theory, the child has sexual desires for the parent of the opposite sex and fantasizes about fulfilling these desires. Repression of these fantasies rather than actual sexual abuse may then lead to adult psychological problems. Freud's theory, which was widely accepted for many years, has now been largely discredited, but many people continue to believe that little children have sexual desires. The North American Man-Boy Love Association is trying to legitimize sex between adults and children by repealing all age of consent laws. They argue that children have sexual desires and the right to engage in sexual activity. However, this argument is nothing more than an attempt to legitimize their own desire to exploit children. Some adults who abuse children rationalize their behavior as merely openness about sexuality or teaching the kids about sex or showing physical affection. Certainly children need to be given a positive attitude towards sexuality, education about sex, and physical affection. But focusing on the sexual nature of child sexual abuse rather than on its abusive nature makes it very difficult to define what is abusive and what isn't. This leads to attempts to establish the thin line between loving physical affection and abusive sexual conduct. Such a line is very difficult to establish theoretically since it focuses on acts rather than motives, but children understand when they are being used or exploited. Equally as problematic as seeing child sexual abuse as permissible because it is sexual is seeing it as wrong because it is sexual. Those who hold this view also need to define the thin line. What is needed is not a list of acceptable and unacceptable sexual behaviors, but a sexual ethic that distinguishes between sexual violence and morally responsible sexual activity. A sexual ethic must regard sex as primarily good and then develop principles to guide us in expressing our sexuality in loving and just ways. Such an ethic would require us to focus on the abusive rather than the sexual nature of child sexual abuse. The Church's teachings about sex encourage seeing the sinfulness of child sexual abuse as primarily sexual. The Church has a standard for sexual conduct, but has never encouraged its members to develop a sexual ethic that seriously inquires into the nature and meaning of sexuality, explores the question of how sexuality can be expressed and discussed in meaningful, healthy, and non-abusive ways, and attempts to locate sexual relations within a context of right relationships between human beings. The Church's standard for sexual conduct is clear. Sexual intercourse outside of marriage is a serious sin which must be confessed to the bishop and may be punished by excommunication or disfellowshipment. Although the Church teaches that sexuality is a God-given gift and that sexual relations in marriage are good, these teachings are eclipsed by Church leaders' rhetoric against sex portrayed in the media. This rhetoric regards any explicit sexual material as pornographic. Such an attitude discourages the exploration of sexuality in literature, art, films, plays, and to a lesser extent, even in scholarly works. This attitude, along with a lack of a sexual ethic, actually assumes that sexuality is evil, although it is permitted under certain conditions. Sex is a powerful force that cannot be ignored. By discouraging a thoughtful approach to sexuality, the Church actually encourages its members to deal with their sexuality in unhealthy ways. The Church's rule-based sexual morality, which focuses on behavior and gives no attention to the quality of relationships, promotes exploitative sexual activity. By making one rule, no sexual intercourse outside of marriage, its main teaching about sexuality, the Church encourages thin-line morality. The main question becomes, what is permissible sexual activity outside of marriage, or how far can I go before I cross the thin line, or how far can I go and still get a temple recommend? Rule-based sexual morality makes self-control the main concern of sexual morality. According to this view, the problem of child sexual abuse can be solved if abusers simply exercise more self-control. This was the point of view President Hinckley took in his 1985 conference address against child sexual abuse, in which he advised child sexual abusers to develop within themselves that discipline which can curb such evil practices. A sexual ethic should be able to distinguish between abusive and or violent sexual activity and morally responsible sexual activity on a principled rather than a rule basis, and it should locate sexual morality within the wider concept of right relationships between individuals. The foundation of right relationship is equality, and equality can only be established by allowing each person self-determination. This means that the basic and minimum requirement for morally responsible sexual activity is mutual consent, and any form of sexual coercion, violence, or behavior directed at another person without that person's consent is unjust and sinful, and in some cases should be considered criminal. Because a child lacks the knowledge and maturity to give meaningful consent, and because he or she lacks the power to have his or her choice respected, a child cannot consent to sexual activity with an adult or older or more powerful child. Locating the sinfulness of child sexual abuse in its abusive nature rather than its sexual nature does not mean that the sexual nature of the abuse is unimportant either to the victim or to the offender. Although a child molester's motives are probably not primarily sexual, certainly he is seeking sexual gratification, and the pleasure he derives from the abuse reinforces his behavior. For a child, the sexual nature of the abuse is very important. Although the child's age and the attitudes and teachings she has received about sexuality will have some effect on how the sexual nature of the abuse affects her, most children will feel shame, disgust, and guilt. Many will feel that they are bad. If they have been taught that their genitals and everything down there is dirty and unmentionable, they will feel dirty and find it difficult to talk about what happened. They may not even have any words or any good words to talk about what was done to them. Mormon children and youth are particularly vulnerable to the sexual nature of sexual abuse. They are continually taught to keep themselves pure, clean, and chaste. The message is that sexual contact makes you unclean. Even if someone else has caused them to be impure and unclean, they are still impure and unclean, still damaged, still unworthy. Even if victims are specifically told that they are not responsible for the abuse, it is still very difficult for them to overcome the many powerful messages about being impure because of sexual contact with another person. If an offender used seductive rather than violent methods to abuse the child, she may have experienced physical pleasure, or she may have enjoyed the attention she received. This may cause her to believe that she somehow consented and thus is guilty. But even if the abuse is in some way pleasant to the child, even if it is not physically painful, even if the child has not been taught that sex is bad, children who are sexually abused feel violated. Survivors of abuse have reported their feelings, and victim after victim has expressed her feeling of being violated, dominated, controlled, used like an object, and humiliated. In Reclaiming Our Lives, Carol Poston and Karen Listenwright For the victim of incest, the temple of the body has been destroyed. In incest, the physically intact self, the body that a child comes to know first as the real self, is someone else's territory, to be intruded upon at his will, without her permission. The genitals are the most private part of the body, and to have this part violated symbolizes the perpetrator's total lack of esteem for the selfhood of the child and her right to bodily integrity and control. Being sexually abused always causes psychological and sometimes physical damage to the child. It is important to understand that this damage is not irreparable. It can be healed, but this healing requires love and work from both the survivor and those who support and care about her. Those who first spoke out about child sexual abuse were very concerned with proving and documenting the damage and problems caused by the abuse. This was important in establishing the seriousness of the problem and the necessity of addressing it legally, therapeutically, and socially. However, from a moral as well as a legal point of view, we must emphasize the intrinsic value of the child and his or her fundamental right as a human being to self-determination and bodily integrity. This is the only firm basis on which to unequivocally affirm the right of the child to not be abused. That a certain action damages or hurts another person is certainly an important moral and legal consideration, but damage must be empirically established, and this may be difficult to do in a court of law. The ethical considerations involved in judging actions or determining actions on the basis of whether or not they hurt another person are also difficult for reasons impossible to go into here. But every person's right to self-determination is fundamental to any free society and any ethic which takes the principle of human equality seriously. There is a fundamental tension in Mormonism between the principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which assume the principle of free agency, and the thoroughly authoritarian nature of the institutional church. The Lord warned us in the early days of the church through the prophet Joseph Smith about the danger and high probability of leaders abusing power. He said, "It is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." Yet despite this warning, we have developed a church system which assumes that almost no one will abuse power. I believe that we as a church have made a grave mistake, first in equating priesthood with church governance, and then in making our church government hierarchical. This makes it impossible for us as a church to achieve the equality mandated by the gospel of Jesus Christ. Several aspects of the Mormon hierarchical system should be noted. It is patriarchal. This means that only males can govern, and that the model of male dominance is based on the concept of the divine right of the father to rule. This idea is clearly outlined in the church's recent proclamation on the family. It states, "In the premortal realm, spirit sons and daughters knew and worshiped God as their eternal father. Although it says that each of us is a beloved spirit son or daughter of heavenly parents, no specific mention is made of God the mother. God refers only to God the Father. God has a plan. God gives commandments. We worship Him as the Father. The clear implication is that fatherhood gives the right to rule. The proclamation declares, by divine design, fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Preside means to be president, to make the decisions, to be in charge. Provide the necessities of life means control the resources, and provide protection means have the power. The proclamation says that mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. Although it adds that fathers and mothers are obligated to help one another as equal partners, the word equal is meaningless in this context. Roles are inherently unequal, and equality can never be realized when individuals are identified with roles. But this is just what the proclamation does. It states, gender is an essential characteristic of individual premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose, and gives the role of each gender. If the mother's eternal role is to nurture her children, then she is under an obligation to nurture. To nurture means to give to sacrifice for. But giving, sacrificing, must be voluntary. An obligatory sacrifice is a forced sacrifice, and a forced sacrifice involves victimization of some kind. The proclamation thus asserts that male's eternal destiny is to rule, and female's eternal destiny is to be exploited. The basic model for relationships given by the proclamation is that of father-child, which subsumes the male-female relationship. This is a dominant-submissive relationship. The father commands and the child must obey. There is no model of a relationship of equality given in the proclamation. Church government is patriarchal, and the basic father-child relationship is maintained in the church institution, where it becomes a leader-member or higher-leader-lower leader relationship. Because all the decision-making power rests in the leader, this is a dominant-submissive relationship. A dominant-submissive relationship is inherently abusive. This requires a little explanation. The concept of abuse is grounded in the principle of human equality. Because people differ in many ways, any relationship involves many real inequalities. When a relationship involves an imbalance of power, the person with the most power should use that power to benefit rather than exploit, dominate, or coerce the person with less power. This means that the more powerful person must respect the personhood, the subjectivity of the less powerful person. He must recognize that she has her own desires, needs, perspectives, and beliefs, which certainly differ from his own and may differ from what he believes hers are or ought to be. To respect her personhood, to treat her as a person of equal value as himself, he must grant her self-determination. This does not mean he cannot influence her. The revelation defining unrighteous dominion explains the righteous use of power. Power can only be righteously exercised by persuasion, long-suffering, meekness, love, kindness, and pure knowledge. In a dominant-submissive relationship, the dominant person controls the submissive person. He makes the decisions and she must follow them, and her submission is obtained by coercive means. The revelation says that exercising control, dominion, or compulsion over any person in any degree is an abuse of power. Can be subverted by the very strong teaching to follow the leaders. This teaching is given the force of commandment and taught relentlessly by both leaders and members in virtually every church meeting. The belief that the prophet is infallible in his utterances to the church is widely held by church members, even though there is no revelation establishing it, no scripture supporting it, no historical precedent for it, even though it contradicts the gospel of Jesus Christ and the principle of free agency, and even though the only argument supporting it is based on a logical fallacy. The aura of infallibility spreads out from the prophet, rests strongly on the 12, and covers other general authorities sufficiently. Though it has thinned out considerably by the time it reaches local leaders, the strong imperative to follow the leaders is widely believed to apply to bishops and stake presidents as well as general authorities. Supporting the imperative to follow the leaders is the belief that it is wrong to publicly disagree with or criticize any idea or action of a church leader. Many Mormons also believe that they should follow their leaders even if doing so would violate their own conscience. The experience of Jack McAllister shows how this follow the leaders teaching can be directly linked to child sexual abuse. Jack explains the feelings that he had as a youth about his bishop. He was the one person in my immediate life to whom I owed my unconditional obedience, since he was the one called by God to be the spiritual leader. It was my understanding that he would always be directly inspired to know the mind and will of God for me. The relationship a member has with his bishop is symbolic of his relationship with God. Failure to do everything the bishop wanted of me meant rebellion, disrespect to God. When he was almost 16 years old, his bishop called him one night to come to the church for an interview. They were the only ones at the meeting house. The bishop said that he had felt directly inspired to call him to his office that night. He pulled his chair close to Jack, put his arm around him, and offered a prayer. After some polite conversation, he began to ask Jack the interview questions. Are you keeping all the commandments? Are you morally clean? Then he said it. Are you masturbating? I didn't say anything. I felt too ashamed and embarrassed. I didn't want to answer him. I didn't know how to answer him. I felt trapped. If I lied to him, I lied to God. I would go straight to hell. If I said yes, my secret would be out. While I was trying to decide how to answer the question with the least risk to my eternal soul, I started to cry. I cried from the deepest part of my gut. How could I be so wicked, so imperfect? What was wrong with me? How could I ever face God or any of his chosen leaders with such a horrible sin crushing my soul? I felt overwhelming shame and rejection. He leaned forward, put one hand on my knee and the other on my thigh. He ran his hand up to my genitals and it rested there in cupping shape. You have a beautiful body, he said. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I can help you with your problem. Then he unzipped my pants, reached into my underwear, and began to fondle my penis. I was too stunned to react, too confused to resist, too unprepared to stop him from doing whatever he felt inspired to do on my behalf to purge my sins from this contemptible body. I couldn't figure out what was going on. He was the bishop. I was the obedient but unworthy servant. He was God's chosen servant on earth. Whatever he did was directly authorized by God. Thus began 3 years of sexual abuse by Jack's bishop. Finally, Jack was able to stop the abuse, but the shame, guilt, pain, anger, disillusionment, loss of faith, loss of self-esteem, distrust of leaders and God remained with him for many years. It is not difficult to see that Jack's bishop sinned in sexually abusing him, or that the abuse violated more than Jack's sexual innocence. It is harder to see that all forms of spiritual and ecclesiastical abuse are equally sinful, even if they do not cause as much damage to the victim. As a church, we have become so enamored with following the leaders that we believe that a leader has the right to punish a member who refuses to comply with his demands. In my work with the Mormon Alliance, I have seen how time after time, disagreements or issues between members and their leaders have quickly degenerated into a demand by the leader that the member submit to his authority or be punished. Such a demand constitutes unrighteous dominion whether or not his directive is justified or good. It is an assault on the integrity of the member and a devaluation of his person. Such abuse can never promote spiritual growth, lead to greater understanding, or increase love or faith in Jesus Christ. It can only gratify the pride and vain ambition of the leader, at the very least, anger, humiliate, or grieve the member. Although church leaders have explicitly denounced child sexual abuse, the power structure of the church and the follow your leader's rule legitimizes it. When the church requires members to obey their leaders, even when doing so violates their own conscience, when it requires members to accept the utterances of leaders as absolute truth, it demands a sacrifice of us even greater than giving up our sexual purity. It violates something more precious than our body. It demands a sacrifice of our judgment, our spiritual feelings, our free agency. It violates our integrity and personhood. It forces us to yield to the church, to a leader, that which should only be given freely to God. The church cannot fight child sexual abuse as long as it legitimizes and defends ecclesiastical and spiritual abuse. The authoritarianism of the church also severely hampers leaders in helping the victims of abuse and hinders members in their healing process. A recent study reported in Ophelia found that the Mormon church is generally not helpful in its interactions with adult survivors of child sexual abuse. The researchers attempted to answer the question, how does the structure of the Mormon church, with its emphasis on men benevolently protecting women and children, affect the healing process of those who have been abused? Of the 71 women interviewed, only 12 had positive interactions with church leaders in dealing with their abuse. 10 of the women in the study said that they chose not to seek help from their church leaders because they had no confidence in their leader's ability to help them. They felt threatened because they believed they would be punished or silenced if they came forward with allegations of abuse. 49 of the women reported negative interactions with church leaders. 5 of these women were actually either disfellowshipped or excommunicated for behaviors such as sexual behavior directly related to their abuse. Although the principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ do promote spiritual healing, the church structure does not. The researchers report, the majority of the women divided the church's leadership structure from its doctrinal or spiritual content, avoiding the former. Healing from abuse requires a personal spiritual journey, which includes questioning, accepting one's individual worth, affirming one's own judgment, and spiritual feelings, becoming responsible for one's own choices, and finding one's own connection to God. The follow your leader's rule undermines the spiritual journey. Probably the most important reason for the church's ineffectiveness in helping victims of abuse is their very strong institutional imperative to protect the image, power, and money of the church. Because Mormon authoritarianism is grounded in the belief that church leaders are called of God, inspired by God, and acting for God, that they are righteous and worthy, it is very important that they are perceived as righteous and worthy. Because virtually every male above the age of 12 in the church holds the priesthood, because priesthood is equated with authority, because every church leadership position requires priesthood, and because the priesthood-bearing father presides in the home, almost all cases of child sexual abuse perpetrated in the church are perpetrated by priesthood-holding authority figures. This means that the need to support the idea that men who hold the priesthood are righteous and worthy influences virtually every interaction between church leaders and those seeking help in dealing with the ongoing abuse or recovering from past abuse. This frequently results in denial, minimization, or cover-up of the problem, blaming the victim and or protecting the perpetrator. Almost every case I know of where church leaders have failed to help the victims and their supporters involves a cover-up of some kind. The Revelation on Unrighteous Dominion warns that using priesthood power to cover sins is an abuse of this authority. Of course, church leaders need to be aware of the possibility of false allegations, and they should require either confession of the perpetrator or adequate evidence of his guilt before imposing any church discipline. But even in cases where the guilt of the perpetrator is not in question, priesthood leaders frequently act to protect the perpetrator and the image of the church. Certainly, perpetrators are in need of pastoral care, therapeutic help, love, and forgiveness, but surely the needs of the child to be protected and healed should come first. Surely the perpetrator is not helped by covering up his sins. Surely followers of Jesus Christ care more about the well-being of a child than the image of the church. Jesus told Peter to feed his sheep, not protect the sheepfold. Sometimes victims are blamed and punished. A 13-year-old holiday girl was sexually abused by a man in her ward who was in his 30s. A church disciplinary court was called against the girl, accusing her of sexual activity, describing it as an affair with a man. Subsequently, she behaved promiscuously with boys her own age. Called to a church court, the girl made a serious suicide attempt. This did not deter the stake president from proceeding with her church discipline. Only when the girl's grandfather intervened by contacting child advocates who threatened public exposure of the case did the stake president drop the action against the girl. Unfortunately, by then the girl had been deeply damaged by both sexual and ecclesiastical abuse. Adult survivors of child sexual abuse who are not seeking any kind of action against the perpetrator but are only asking for help in healing from the abuse are often not believed or blamed. One Provo woman struggled alone for years, telling no one about the sexual abuse her father had inflicted upon her. Finally, she went to the stake president. He knew her father, having served with him on the regional high council. He told the woman that she must be wrong. Her father was an honorable man because he had held a high church position. The most egregious case of protecting the perpetrator and image of the church while ignoring the needs of suffering children occurred recently in West Virginia. James F. Adams, who was divorced and had custody of his two young children, confessed to his bishop, who was also his father, that he was sexually abusing both his children. He was being blackmailed by the children's babysitter, who had made an audio tape of the children disclosing the abuse. Adams' bishop reported the abuse and the blackmail to the stake president and to Adams' employer, who was also a church member. According to the complaint later filed on behalf of Adams' daughter against the church and Adams' employer, Adams' bishop, James F. Adams Sr., perceived the threat posed to Adams Jr. and the church by the blackmail attempt and felt that the stake president could help in containing damage to the church's reputation. Neither the bishop, the stake president, the father's employer, nor any other man in the stake who knew of the abuse ever reported the abuse to law enforcement agencies or did anything to protect or help the children. Adams continued to abuse his children frequently and sadistically during the next 5 years until finally the children's mother, who lived in Alaska, learned of a 55-minute videotape that Adams had made of his molestation of his children. She informed the police and Adams was arrested and convicted. The material compiled in the case reports of the Mormon Alliance provides ample evidence that cover-up of the problem of child sexual abuse in the church extends to the highest levels in the church hierarchy, and that this cover-up is principally based on a perceived need to protect the image and money of the church. The civil suit complaint against Adams states that before his trial, Adams was repeatedly visited by his stake president and other church officials who urged Adams to plead guilty to all 37 charges against him to protect defendants, LDS Church, Corporation of the President, Corporation of the Presiding Bishopric, from embarrassment and possible civil liability, and also so as not to interfere with the flow of tithes the LDS Church received each year. This concern for money over the lives of children is also confirmed in a count of comments made by President Hinckley, reported by Marion Smith in an article on child sexual abuse in the Mormon Church, recently published in The Event. In September 1994, Hinckley addressed a regional priesthood meeting in Calgary, Canada. Smith writes, "Two men who attended the meeting but asked not to be identified reported that President Hinckley responded to questions about child sexual abuse, warning leaders that if they had the least inkling that people have a problem with this, then they should be left out of church positions. Hinckley instructed leaders to watch for and take action on cases of sexual abuse, since these cases were costing the church millions of dollars in lawyers' fees and settlements. Hinckley said, it cost the church time and money to fight these things, and added that the church is being sued for millions. The complaint filed on behalf of Adams' daughter accuses, in these cases, defendants have raised constitutional defenses they know to be without merit, have engaged in protracted litigation solely for the purpose of inflicting the maximum emotional trauma on the plaintiff victims of sexual abuse, have routinely entered into secret settlements totaling millions of dollars to silence these victims and further suppress evidence of the nature and extent of the problem among its members. These settlements are routinely reached on the courthouse steps. Defendants' general authorities are the architects of these legal strategies designed to inflict the maximum emotional trauma on the children plaintiffs in order to extract a favorable settlement. They have, at the highest levels of the LDS Church, engaged in a calculated strategy to hinder or obstruct vigorous investigation of complaints of child sexual abuse of and by its members, have attempted by entering into secret settlements with victims to suppress evidence of the nature and extent of child sexual abuse among its members, have ignored repeated warnings by its clergy and legal counsel that this problem needed to be addressed candidly and vigorously, all to preserve the image and wealth of the Church. As the full weight of the evidence of the Church's complicity in child sexual abuse fell upon me, I groaned in my spirit. Surely, as a Church, we are idolaters. For we are sacrificing our children, our powerless ones, to the image of the Church. I thought of the words of Moroni which condemn us. Ye do love money and your substance and your fine apparel and the adorning of your churches, the image of the Church, more than ye love the poor and the needy, the sick and the afflicted. I thought of the 8-year-old boy who was severely sexually abused by his father. When his primary president told the story of Daniel and said that God would help them when they were in trouble, he angrily raised his hand and said that this was not true. His 7-year-old sister refuses to pray because she'd pray and pray, begging that if the abuse had to continue, that at least Heavenly Father would make it so that it didn't hurt so bad. But it always hurt just as bad. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones who believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned at the depths of the sea. I cried, O Lord, how long? How long will you suffer the cries of these little ones to come up to you in vain? And the Spirit came upon me and said, prophesy against the leaders of my Church. And I said in my heart, how can I do it? I do not wish evil upon anyone. And the Spirit said to me, they will bring it upon themselves. And I wrote the words which the Spirit put into my mind. In their folly, in their blindness, in their pride, they have said, let us lead the people and we will never lead them astray. They have taught the people to revere their leaders rather than to have faith in Jesus Christ. They have said that peace and safety lie in following them. And the leaders have abused the people. They have laid heavy burdens on them, too grievous to be borne. They have not led them to Jesus Christ, who would have lifted their burdens, wiped their tears, and healed their wounds. But they heap more burdens upon them and lash their backs if they did not move quickly enough. They have used the people to gratify their pride, satisfy their appetites, and cover their sins. Woe, woe be to all leaders who have eaten the flock and not fed them. Woe, woe, especially to those high leaders in high places who sit upon their thrones of power and do not heed the cries of the little ones, but sacrifice them to that great god Moloch whose image they have erected in the shadow of my temple, because they would rather that the children suffer than have one blemish put upon that great idol which they have served, the idol of their power, the idol of their influence, the idol of their reputations. They would rather that the little ones suffer than destroy that great idol of leader infallibility, that great idol of follow your leaders. O people of my Church, how oft have I pled unto you to come unto me, but ye would not. How oft would I have comforted you with my Spirit and poured down my revelations upon your heads, but ye would not. Instead, ye preferred to follow your leaders. You praise them all the day, but me ye have not looked for nor found. For I am found upon the cross, and you are ashamed of me. You could not bear to be humiliated. You praise the rich and successful and honored them, but the poor and the wounded and the hungry you have not regarded, but have blamed them for their own condition and cast them aside. And because you have not led my people unto me, but have set yourselves up as a guide and a light for them, it shall be done to you even as you said. You shall be responsible for all their afflictions. All that you have afflicted upon them shall be returned unto you. Your secret sins and works of darkness and counsels of deceit shall be published abroad. And those who revered you, who well nigh worshipped you, shall despise you. And all this will surely come to pass unless ye repent. Therefore, repent ye and come unto me, saith the Lord. We cannot stop the abuse. We cannot bind up the wounds if we are the Church of infallible leaders. If we are the Church of high moral standards, if we are the Church of perfect families, we must be the Church of Jesus Christ. And we must look for him on the cross where he bore the pain of our abuse and the humiliation of our sins. We must feel the pain of the abused. We must hear their anger. We must feel the pain of our own abuse, that which we have suffered and that which we have inflicted upon others. And with his stripes we are healed. Jesus offers healing to the abused and rebirth to the abusers. And after we are risen with him, Let us receive forgiveness. Forgiveness for our sins and forgiveness for those who have sinned against us, which he gives to all those who come unto him.
Thank you, Janice. We are out of time. There's no time for question-answer period, but Janice said if any of you would like to speak with her one-on-one, she'd be happy to speak with any and all of you. Thank you.